session number 9483, reel 9.
Mr. Templer, reel 9.
Right, and he was running fast towards where Corporal Ayton and John and his group, about half a dozen of them, were in this particular post, and therefore close to where the Germans were likely to be. I yelled, and he took no notice, so I ran after him. And instead of taking notice, he ran doubled up because he was in a panic. And he ran with his head down. And as he got to a certain spot, a grenade was thrown over. It burst, and he fell. I followed up, and I got to him very quickly and picked him up, and his blood gushed all over me because the wound had severed it at the front of his throat. He cut, I should think, the major veins in his throat because it was there. And it would only be a matter of seconds before he would be dead. I tried to talk to him, but he couldn't understand. I told him, I said, I have to go and find the other group, like Corporal Ayton, because they'd obviously moved away from there. And I couldn't carry him. Frankly, I was at that time pretty well exhausted, you know, without any sleep and that sort of thing. And I'd got all my work cut out to keep myself going. However, I couldn't have carried him because the blood was pouring out of him like a, you know, bucketful. And I just tried to make him understand, but he just couldn't. And he was, in other words, he was damn near dead then. And so I had to leave him, which was very trying, but it didn't alter the fact that I couldn't do anything. So I moved away, and as I moved up a slope, I wanted to keep contact with the main body, with the officer, and Corporal Ayton and John's lot. I wanted to gather them all together if I could. And all of a sudden I was going up an incline, and shells were bursting. And then I think one must have burst overhead because I was suddenly hit in my left shoulder, just below on the shoulder blade, and I was absolutely knocked flat on my face. It was so severe, it felt like a sledgehammer knocking me down. And you know, you'd fall straight on your face then. And as I fell, I had a glimpse of a couple of khaki figures near me. And there was RAMC officer, a captain in the RMC, and a chaplain. And they were actually both carrying rifles. However,
well, that was very unusual, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't. He shouldn't have done it. But the point was this: they were non-competent. The point is that they were carrying rifles, but the doctor came over where I lay face down, and he turned me over. And he looked at my face, which wasn't very pretty at that moment, with the splinters and that sort of thing. And he looked at me very hard generally, and then he said, "Where were you hit?" And I said, "My left shoulder, sir." I said, "I felt as though I'd been hit with a sledgehammer." And he turned me over on my face again, and he said, "The buckle of your equipment is buckled. The buckle of your equipment is buckled, see? But there's no blood." So it hadn't gone in, and he turned me back again. He said, he looked at my face again, he said, "I think you've had enough, you better bugger off." So I thanked him, and I said, "Sir, I will move." So I picked myself up rather carefully, and I moved off, and I found Corporal Ayton with John and the others about another 50 or 60 yards farther on. They'd stopped. John was on a little light hand cart with big wheels, God knows what it'd been used for, and they put him on there, but he'd got shrapnel in both legs. Billy Ayton had been knocked out by something that hit him on the head. Anyway, his intelligence was about the same as normal, and the others had been a bit shaken, but nobody very seriously. So I said, "What the hell are you all standing here for?" I said, can't you move away and get John out of this? He should be taken out of this. There had been was a couple of RAMC orderlies close by, and they had obviously put field dressings on the shrapnel wounds in his legs, just below the backside, I expect it was. And but he was in a pretty unpleasant, you know, very upset. And so he grabbed my hand. He said, "Charles, get me out." I said, "Yes, I will. I'll get you out, all right. But I've got to go and find the others anyway. But if I've got to look after you all here, I can't do both things." So I decided that I would get him out because of the fact that he was my pal. And another thing, there was a certain lady in the question. And the other thing was that I felt it was better for me to do that because the others had got the officer. So after a bit of cogitation, I said, "Right, Billy, get them moving. You can pull that handcart between you, and we'll move off." And we moved them off, and we came across a lorry where some either brigade headquarters had been or something of the sort. But they were pulling out. In other words, they were stripping their place of all their documents and everything else and going back to the base area. And we arrived, and I went and saw the driver. I spoke to the driver, and I said, "What can you do? Can we get these chaps on your lorry?" And he looked at me, and he looked at the men, and he said, "Yes, yeah, get yourselves in that back of that lorry, and we should be off in a minute or two." So I got them in to the lorry and myself, and I was kept at the base hospital for patching up. John and the rest of them got home to England on the sick ship or whatever it was.
Do you remember which base hospital it was that you were sent to?
No, I don't remember. I forget where it was. I don't know.
It sounds as if things were fairly chaotic.
What?
It sounds as if things were fairly chaotic. Had they been able to set up things like field
Well, the point was that we were fighting a rear guard.
Had they been able to set up field dressing stations?
Oh, well, they probably had, but the point was that the movement had been very rapid, you see. Because after all, then we'd marched 25 or 30 kilometres up, and we were marching just as fast back again after a virtual day's hold-up, you see. No, I had no instructions. I didn't know what I was ought to do, and a strange officer couldn't tell me what the other bloke had been told to do.
It must have been quite a change to become involved with fighting in open country instead of the...
Oh, it was a change. It was much better. I preferred it that way because I could shoot. I could see my enemy and I could knock him off. I felt very good about that. But anyway, I got back to this base hospital eventually when I was... I remember being... There was a reception area for wounded, and I expect I looked a bit bedraggled with bunged up eyes and a damaged shoulder. It hadn't broken anything, but it was when I was sent treated at the hospital part of it for my eyes and that, and moved into a more or less a convalescent camp because I could move about. I was put into a marquee with a lot of other sergeants or warrant officers.
Do you remember where that was?
No, not precisely, not the area at all.
But we're still talking about March, April 1918.
By the end of March and the beginning of April 1918. Don't take me back 2 years. I don't want another 2 years of this. Anyway, that was where it was in 1918, and it was somewhere not far from a railhead at that particular point. So where was the railhead? I don't know. John and his lot were taken through, treated, and put on hospital train. I was kept at the base hospital, and because I was obviously capable of moving about, and they treated my eyes. They orderly came down to wherever I was every morning, and they had a business of bathing eyes and examining me, and also another one came along to massage my shoulder and talk to me about it, and I said, "You know, I might have got a blighty one if it hadn't been for the buckle." And he said, "No, you'd have been dead, mate. So I had to be thankful. Then, having eventually, I was eventually sent back to the battalion.
How long were you out of active service?
I don't know. Probably a fortnight, 3 weeks or something like that. You see, it might have been longer. I don't remember what particular month it was. It was early. And when I got back to the headquarters of what was left of them, you see, they lost about 600 men in 4 days.
Where was the headquarters?
Somewhere behind the line between the Kingdom Come and the front line. I don't remember where it was now.
Is it still near Albert?
Still somewhere in that area. But probably farther back, I don't know. And it's impossible for me to answer that. But then, when I got back to them, when I got back to the place where the remnants of the battalion were, I found the orderly room tent, because there was always an orderly room tent, and it was a bell tent. And I went there, and I saw the orderly room sergeant and the other orderly room clerk. He was just a private. And when I walked into there, they were all excited. They were really very thrilled to see me back again. And they said, "God, fancy seeing you again." I said, "What's it all about?" He said, "Well, you've been recommended for the DCM." Oh, I've been rather facetious. I said, "Do you mean district court martial?" They said, "No, you silly bugger." But I didn't get either. However, it was quite exciting. And then I noticed that a lot of men who had been with me had also got back with the strange officer. He got them back. He obviously knew where to head for, you see. Because when I moved through the camp after I'd been, you know, made fit again, whenever I moved from one place to another, there'd be a bunch of them standing talking. And you know how men, when they talk about you, Englishmen at any rate, they sort of stop talking about you and they just look at you. So I probably gave them a wave or something like that, and they'd all wave back. You know, and I was going perhaps to the order room to get orders or something like that. But the men there were all talking about me. So eventually I asked the order room clerk on whose word had I been recommended. And they said, "Well, frankly, it was because the men were so excited, if you like, or pleased about what had happened. I looked after everybody." So that was the story.
Although the recommendation would have had to have come from the officer, in fact, wouldn't it? The recommendation itself would have had to have come from the officer.
From an officer, but the officer who was with him was just a temporary man to take them back to the battalion. And our own officer had been made prisoner at his own request, so to speak. That didn't matter to me. I met him afterwards, many years.
This is the officer that was
the
captured.
Officer that let me go, you know, let me in. He was in a tea room in a restaurant under Great Portland Street Station. I was operating in that area, Camden Town. I went down. I usually got myself a roll and butter, a cup of tea, and a piece of cheese, just for a quick snack, you see. And there was, as I went down the stairs, it was an underground restaurant. I saw this bloke staring up at me open mouth. It was about 1927. And I thought, "Christ, I know." Yes, I knew who he was. He was the lieutenant who was in charge of the signals and then buzzed off with the German. So I went on down, walked over to his table. I got a briefcase in my hand with my clobber, you know, and I put my briefcase down on his table, put my hands on the table in front of him, leaned over and said, "You bastard." And he didn't utter a word. So afterwards, I went and got my roll, butter, cheese and tea and sat with me back to where he was. And when I finished, which wasn't very many minutes, I got up to move off again and look after my affairs. And he'd already moved off. He'd disappeared. I thought, poor bugger. I'd have wanted to die.
So, following your injury, you returned to your battalion after 2 or 3 weeks, which means you were probably back there about April 1918.
April to May.
The
German advance had effectively been halted by then.
Well, no, it was slowing up, that's certain. But after that period, it wasn't very long, because they must have lost a tremendous number of men, the Germans. But they had been training for this effort as a result of the Russian Revolution, you see. But in any case, when I got back to the battalion and was greeted as I was, I was obviously being kept back, because they, I was sent to on a separate duty to join the New York Division, the American New York Division, which had just landed in France, only just landed. And they sent me because they wanted me to give instruction and information to the American signalers of the division concerning the sort of work they'd have to do in the front line and the areas around the front line. So I had the signalers in a group, and I didn't try to teach them anything. I might talk to them about the sort of things that they could expect.
Whereabouts was this posting?
Camarade, I can't remember. It was somewhere in that area of France. The point is that you don't make notes of places like that, because you know you're only temporarily there. And so, but it was rather interesting. I suppose I was with them for a week, several weeks, in fact, and I got on very well with them. In fact, it was quite exciting at the time, because they got paid every week, and we got paid when we could. And they always got all their pay in one bite, and they usually got drunk. So much so that they had a happy knack of having a few casualties created with stab wounds when they started to attack the kitchen police, they used to call the cooks. And there was also one incident there when I was sent there as a sergeant signaller. There was one of my other comrades who was a sergeant machine gunner, you see, and we were sent there to talk to our various respective jobs to these Americans. There was also one or two kilties. There was one sergeant of one of the kilted regiments, I forget who it was now, but one of the Americans made rather a slighting remark about the old women they put in these kilts, you see, or something a bit of an insult to the kilt, you see, and being the Scot, and we had a mess marquee where we were all sitting down together on a long form like table with small forms either side, you see. And so we were sitting there eating our meal. Most of the British troops were on one side of the table and all the Americans on the other. And this particular man sitting opposite this jock sergeant, they passed a silly remark about his kilt, you know. And the Scottish sergeant looked at him very quietly and stood up, and he said, "Forgive me, sergeant, but I prefer to be standing up when anybody says things like that, and I don't hear very well. Perhaps you'd like to repeat it," or words to that effect. And the American quite gaily said, "Yes, you know, sometimes about girls with men with skirts on or something." So the jock leaned forward and gave him such a clout under the jaw that he landed back against the side of the marquee tent side, canvas side. He knocked him back, the form that he was sitting on went over, and he finished up in a heap. And all the other, all the British NCOs stood up, expecting a rough house. But nothing happened. They said, yeah, the Yanks said, "Well, serve him bloody well right, take him outside and chuck him out." So we sat down again.
How did you get on with the Americans?
Oh, all right. They were full of titles. They had master sergeants who were warrant officers, and they all had a very extraordinary delicate equipment. They had their talcum powders and all sorts of things like that. They had a terrific amount of personal kit. In fact, I was billeted with them in a barn where their store was, and one night a German plane came over and dropped a bomb or two nearby, and all the Americans skedaddled out of the barn, you know, and got into the open field, and I and my other British sergeant, we just laid rolled up in our blanket. We were just as well off there as anywhere else. And as I was interested in one or two pieces of equipment that I saw they'd got, I got over my blanket, popped over a low wall that divided us from the store, and helped myself to whatever it was I wanted, and popped back into the blanket came. And then eventually the Yanks came back, and they said, "Are you still here?" "Yes, there was nothing to worry about. What the hell are you running about for?" "Oh, I mean, you know, we were heroes all at once then, and we knew we'd better off where we were." That was my last experience with the Yanks. I went up the line with them when they were taking over, and helped them with the procedure of handing the signals over, taking over from the signals of the people who were in the line. And then everybody except the Americans were free, and I returned to the battalion.
Did they strike you as being well trained?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't study them. I was there. Their signalers were quite intelligent. But what about the rest of them? I was intimate with those who concerned me, you see.
So that would just be the
And
signalers,
I mixed
really?
Up with their what was equivalent to our regimental sergeant majors, you know, which was master sergeants or whatever they were. As individuals, they were quite pleasant. Mm. But
they seemed to know their jobs. They seemed to know what they were about.
It's a job to tell. It's something that you assume that they knew what they were doing, but the point is they didn't have much experience of the sort of war that we'd been in.
And your role was to hopefully give them some of that experience.
Well, I gave them what information, and I went up with them and supervised or helped them with the takeover from the signalers that they were relieving, because another division was moving out, you see. And these people took over their signal, their equipment and everything else was being left behind for them. That's as far as I recollect. But I was released. That on the march to going up the line, though I had been troubled with I had been gassed, and it was rather hot weather, and what with the earlier skirmishing in the year, I felt a bit queer, and I almost collapsed, so I had to fall out, and one of my chaps stayed with me, and somebody came along and said, "What is the matter with the sergeant?" And he said, "Oh, this is the gas, effective gas. He'll be all right in a minute. He'll be following on." So I got up shortly afterwards. I got a bit better, and I caught them up again. But of course they were very nice. I had all sorts of invitations to go to New York particularly, but I never went. I had other things to do. And of course later on, when I returned to the battalion, I had another little job, temporary job, with at one of the malarial camps, because people who'd been out in the Middle East picked up malaria, and they were sent back to France to a camp there to act as a convalescent place. And I was given the job as acting quartermaster sergeant. And amongst my duties was to receive a consignment of Guinness, bottled Guinness, which was of which all the people who had malaria were issued with so many bottles a day to sort of build them up. One of my, or a couple of my pals, but one particular fellow, I've got a photograph of him, as you can see sometime. I remember his name was Kilby. He was a 6-footer and tough and anything. And he and his pal were great pals of mine, you see. There is a story which I'll tell you about that another time. But he was with me, and there was also a sergeant from a group who came from Birmingham, a different regiment. And he and Sergeant Kilby, who were, because I was called a master sergeant, they were under me. They got rather antagonistic, I don't know why, but that was there a few. And once or twice they got aggressive to each other, and on one occasion when we had a spare bottle of Guinness, that because somebody who should have had that bottle or several of them were transferred to a hospital, there were surplus bottles which we used to sit in the quartermaster's office in the evening and consume between us, which was very useful and very pleasant. And then these two started getting at loggerheads. Well, there's me. I was about 5'7" or 5'8" in those days, and these two were 6 footers, which was unusual. The Birmingham man was very beefy as well, and they were going for each other. So I got up, I picked up an empty Guinness bottle, which was about a half pint size or something like that. I didn't want to hit them very hard, but they were going to damage each other, so I tapped one on the head, back of the head, a bit severely, and he shook his head and didn't like it, and I went round the other guy and I tapped him, and they both shut up then. I said, I'll hit you hard next time if you don't bloody well stop, and that's what they did. So they became friends. I think.
Whereabouts was this malaria camp?
Oh, you and your whereabouts, I don't know. Somewhere in France it was. And then after that, I was sent back again, recalled to the battalion. I took Sergeant Kilby with me, I think, if I remember right, for his safety. I was told I was going to be sent on home on leave very shortly.
What time of year would this be?
This is getting on toward the end of September. Towards the end. Or it might have been in September. Because I decided, having heard that I was going home on leave, and that I looked as though I was going to be kept out of any rough stuff, and I could felt that as the German attack had faltered and stopped and everything was going back and the Allies were going forward again, I thought there was a chance that I might survive. So I wrote home to my lady love's father. I told him that I'd been in love with her for 4 years, and I'd like to know whether he would have any objection to me as a potential son-in-law, as I wanted to ask her to marry me. And he wrote back and said no, except one little stipulation of his own, which was that I should take out an insurance policy on my life for £100 made out in favour of his daughter. Now, in 1918, £100 was a lot of money. So I acknowledged the responsibility and that I would see to it when I came home on leave. So I came home on leave on the 2nd of October, 1918. I went to Baker Street where my parents were living. And I previously stopped and had a bath at one of the rail heads because my folks hadn't got a bathroom. They were in this sort of unfortunate situation of being caretakers and no bathroom. And when I had that, I got to my parents in the late afternoon, the 2nd of October, and I rang Days up at her home. And she said, I'll come down to Baker Street and meet you there outside the tube station. It was a blackout, and I met her there. As she got off the bus, she walked straight up to me and she said, Charles, are you quite sure I'm the one you want? And I kissed her for the first time. And that was it.
So how long were you on leave for on that occasion?
About 7 or 10 days.
And
we met every day then. And actually, while I was